Yes. So on the line, we have Dr. Catherine Barraclough, who is the Victorian Chair of Doctors for the Environment Australia. Catherine's going to be speaking about the health effects, the long-term health effects of bushfire smoke exposure. And welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thank you.
Excellent. Now, we spoke previously about the health effects, and there's an article coming up in the Green Left about that very topic. Can you give us a quick overview of Doctors for the Environment and what their aim is?
So Doctors for the Environment is a group of, a relatively large group, about 1,300 doctors and medical students from across Australia. The concept that we work to is healthy planet, healthy people, and so that really centres around the idea that if we don't maintain and protect a healthy environment, there's no way that people can stay healthy.
Mm.
You know, it seems very obvious when you say it, but it's often forgotten that we are absolutely dependent on having clean air, clean water. We need stable, healthy soils to grow nutritious foods, and we need a relatively stable climate. So what we do is we work to protect the environment for the sake of protecting human health.
Excellent. And just in the regards to the bushfire crisis that we've had, we've spoken previously about the long-term health effects, and I know that something that you mentioned stuck with me. This crisis is absolutely unprecedented. We don't seem to have any data to show what the short, medium and long-term effects of bushfire smoke exposure are. Can you talk about that and what they might be and how we might come to find these out?
Well, we have some idea of the potential short-term impact. So what we do know is that smoke bushfire smoke is made up of a really complex mix of gases and particles. You know, there are hundreds of different components of bushfire smoke, and many of those have documented health effects. So, for instance, probably the most damaging particle in bushfire smoke is one called PM2.5. So PM stands for particulate matter, and 2.5 refers to the size of these particles, and they're so tiny that they can be inhaled very deeply into the lungs. Even well people with no underlying medical conditions, they can be very irritating to the respiratory tract, so they can cause eye, nose, throat irritation, things like wheeze and cough and shortness of breath. But they can be really problematic in people with underlying conditions like asthma or chronic obstructive airways disease. The other problem with these particles is that they can be absorbed very deeply into the lungs. From the lungs, be absorbed into the bloodstream and lead to inflammation. And from there, they've been associated with a whole range of health impacts. These include things like heart attacks, lung cancer, worsening of diabetes, preterm birth. So they're a particular concern in pregnant women. More recently, there have been studies linking these very small particles with things like blood infections, fluid and electrolyte disorders, urinary tract infections, acute kidney injury. So they're really dangerous particles, and we sort of know that they cause these health impacts. What we don't know is what sort of health impacts they will lead to in the context of these, or sort of the degree of impacts we will see in relation to these sort of bushfires. We know that being exposed to higher pollution levels for longer time carries an increased risk of health impacts, a bit like cigarette smoking. But it can be really difficult to predict the risks accurately until after the event, because risks will vary between individuals depending on, you know, things like whether they have underlying health conditions. As you said, exposure to bushfire smoke over prolonged periods is absolutely uncharted territory. What's even more uncertain is what sort of health impacts we'll see in the medium to longer term. It's probably reasonable to assume we will see quite substantial health impacts. We know from some of the data that's come out of the Hazelwood coal mine fires, which burnt for 6 weeks, that there were impacts in the medium term. And what's been shown from those fires is that adults had an increased rate of respiratory symptoms even a year out from the event. Children who are exposed to the mine fire smoke, either in utero or in the first 2 years of their life, had more respiratory tract infections, as reported by their parents. So, you know, there's that sort of data that shows that we do see medium-term impacts, but as I said, exactly what we'll see from these fires, you know, will only be shown over time.
Mm. And it's interesting. I think a lot of the general populace is under the impression that people who are vulnerable already, you know, those with respiratory infections, those who are already ill, are only going to be the only ones who are going to be affected by this fire. But what your data seems to be saying is that healthy people and, you know, children who are exposed to this either, you know, early in life or in utero are also going to be possibly suffering these long-term effects. You know, do you think that there's maybe a disconnect between the community's perception of the health effects of smoke and what the health effects of smoke are, in that perhaps we are under this false assumption that healthy people aren't really going to be affected by the smoke?
Look, I mean, I think to some extent, my perception just from being out and about over the last few weeks is that the general population is relatively concerned. And I've got young children and lots of friends with young children, and I mean, it's really difficult to know what to do on those polluted days. It intuitively makes sense that sending your kids outside to breathe in that air is not good for them. And I think, you know, there has been a lot of general public concern. I mean, at the same time, you know, we see people still out exercising and riding their bikes, et cetera, which I suppose suggests there may be a disconnect. The thing to think about there, though, is that, you know, what the recommendation is to stay inside and put on your air conditioner and internally circulate air if you can. Not all people have well-sealed houses with air conditioners. Mm. I mean, we only have one car in our house, and so I was forced to ride to work on those days, despite the fact that is theoretically not a sensible thing to do. So, you know, I think it's really important we get the information out there that everyone is at risk, so that there's as little disconnect as possible, but also to recognise that not everyone has the ability to control, you know, their external environment. And so we really need to make sure that as a society we look out for those people and put in measures so that people can be as safe as possible during these sorts of events.
Absolutely. It sort of brings to the point of, 3CR is all about giving a voice to the marginalised. We haven't really probably touched on the effects of people who are homeless, who are constantly exposed to the smoke, and, people who can't particularly alter their behaviour if they work outside and they do exercise outside as part of their work, those sorts of things. Now, that sort of brings me to the point of what kind of practical measures can we take to minimise our exposure to smoke? I know we've spoken about this previously, and we'll talk about the complications of the things that we might be able to do as well.
Yeah, so the most commonly given advice is that if you can, stay inside. So, you know, close up your house before the smoke impacts. Don't be in a situation where you're surrounded by the smoke if you can help it. Avoid strenuous activity. If you are breathing deeply, it follows from that you're inhaling all these polluting particles further into your lungs. So, you know, try to avoid exercise. Air conditioners often suck in air from outside. So if you do have an air conditioner and you have it on, see if you can alter it so that it recirculates air inside. If you've got any sort of predisposing medical condition or a condition that predisposes you to more trouble during these sorts of events, make sure that you take any prescribed medications. If you have a worsening of symptoms, make sure you seek medical help relatively quickly. I think a really big one is just to look out for each other. So if you have neighbours or people that you know of that you think may be at particular risk, check in on them. The big question that's been out and about is about masks and whether they're protective. Standard masks are not. So the kind of masks that, for instance, you know, surgeons wear in operating theatres, or the paper and cloth masks that you can get, don't filter out those very fine damaging particles that we've talked about just now. There are masks called P2 masks that are designed to filter out PM2.5. And the caveat to that is that those masks have to be incredibly well fitted if they're going to work. So if you have any sort of leak around the face, they're not going to work. They can be hard to fit well in children. They definitely are not going to seal well if you are a person with facial hair. So a risk with those masks is that they can give a false sense of security, and they really should only be used as a backstop. They shouldn't be considered, you know, the stopgap measure to prevent impacts from air pollution. The other issue is, you know, based in Melbourne, there has been a major shortage of P2 masks. They've all been sold out over this period. So, yes, they may help, but they're certainly not perfect and certainly not the answer. I suppose the other thing is that those masks were not designed for these sort of conditions. They're designed for people who work in certain occupations where they may be exposed. They've never been tested on a sort of population-wide level under conditions of prolonged bushfire smoke.
So, in other words, we don't really know if these masks are effective, and we won't really start to know until we've actually tested them out. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, that sort of all of this research is really important because I think a major thing we have to recognise is that this is unlikely to be a one-off event. Our climate is changing. We were warned that we would see these kind of events, and then the likelihood is we will see more of them. So, you know, background research into what works, what doesn't work, which populations are particularly vulnerable, how we can best prepare as a society is incredibly important going forward.
Yeah. In terms of this time of kind of crisis around the bushfire smoke, whether it's your personal opinion or that of doctors for the environment, what are some of the demands that you think that the federal government should be doing, especially in terms of funding, etc., to kind of address the kind of health impacts of this bushfire smoke?
Well, I mean, the bushfires are absolutely a wake-up call to all of us, and I think particularly, hopefully, our government to seriously address the changing climate that is threatening our health and lives. You know, we all know that climate change is influencing these bushfires and extreme weather events the world over. The other thing that we know is that climate change is the greatest health threat facing us. You know, this has been recognised by the medical community at large, including the World Health Organisation, and what follows from this is that we absolutely need to cut carbon pollution, and that is a major ask of DEA for our federal government. You know, if our government doesn't urgently address emissions, then all the effort it's pouring into fighting fires and recovery efforts are really just band-aids. So really that is a major ask. We need to address our emissions. We so desperately need federal leadership in this space. For the sake of human health. The other thing that we need is a climate and health strategy. Yes. And some countries are quite advanced in this area. We certainly are not in Australia. If we acknowledge that climate change is the greatest health threat facing us, we need to prepare for the impact that's going to have. There are fundamental gaps in policy at the moment. Everything is quite piecemeal. So we need to work out how best to minimise and respond to the health impacts of climate change. The kind of things a climate and health strategy would look at is pathways to significant investment in appropriate research, as I mentioned before. We also need to think about which sort of climate change mitigation strategies would be the most effective at protecting health. So there are all sorts of things we need to do to cut carbon emissions. But certain policies would have really substantial benefits for human health at the same time, and so there needs to be a lot of thought into promoting and pushing those sorts of things. For instance, if we could redesign our cities in such a way that they promoted active transport, things like walking and cycling, that would not only address the carbon emissions that arise from motor vehicles, but that would also reduce air pollution. It would also mean that our population would be more physically active, and physical inactivity is a major killer in our society. So that's sort of a win-win solution that we should be thinking about going forward.
And if if someone was a medical student or a doctor who's very keen to learn more about this and to perhaps get involved, how would they get involved with Doctors for the Environment Australia? Can you give us some the website and what they have? They might actually get involved.
Yeah, so we are always on the lookout for new members. The more members we have, the more influence and ability to expand our reach. Doctors for the Environment has a huge range of resources on their website that are publicly available to anyone. In terms of membership, there's a button on the website that you can press to join. The website for DEA is DEA, for Doctors for the Environment Australia.org.au.
Excellent. And was there anything, we're getting to the end of the interview, but was there anything that we haven't touched on or anything that you wanted to reiterate in these last minutes?
I suppose one thing that I didn't mention in terms of a climate and health strategy, we also need to make sure that we prepare our healthcare system. So yes, we will see an increasing burden of disease as a result of climate change. We know that in the very high bushfire smoke period in Sydney before Christmas, there was a 25% increase in presentations to hospital with respiratory problems and a 30% increase in ambulance call-outs. That really puts strain on the healthcare system. So we need to make sure that our healthcare system is able to cope as well. So I think really the big things that have to come out of this is dealing with the risks we're facing now and making sure that people stay safe. But then in addition to that, really looking at the background issues that are driving these fires and the consequences. So, urgently addressing our emissions and then making sure that our communities, our healthcare system, our societies are prepared and able to cope for what will come in the future.
Absolutely, and it will come. Thank you so much, Catherine. We appreciate that you've come on to the show, and keep up the good work with Doctors for the Environment of Australia.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So that was Dr. Catherine Barraclough, who is the Chair of Doctors for the Environment Australia in Victoria, talking about the health effects of long-term exposure or even short-term exposure to the bushfire smoke amidst this bushfire crisis.